All right, good to see everybody this morning. This is the ninth in our series on marriage and divorce. A very full presentation, by far the longest one that I've done. That by request, as a matter of fact. It's difficult for me, as I'm sure it must be for you as well, to be wrestling with what have always been a controversial and difficult topic. I hope that you're finding it at least useful in seeing maybe what I would estimate is not even 50% of the questions and the problems and the great debates that have taken place through the years on this particular topic. And so, again, as I did last week, very much want to encourage everybody, please be making your lists of what I'm calling questions, comments, observations, and objections, and we'll then try to take up all of those at the end. We'll have a whole class, I'm sure, on that, maybe more than one. Hopefully, I can answer all of those questions for you. Certainly, I have answered them to my own satisfaction, but no doubt I'll be overlooking various things that you'd like to delve into. So we'll certainly have a class or two on that at the end. This morning, I'd like to do a little broader study of Jesus' mission on this earth. What was Jesus doing? He had three and about half years that he was in the public eye. He had lived a perfectly sinless life by the Old Testament's definition, by Old Testament law, for these 30 years, so that now he would have his life's work, in his case, compressed into a mere 3.5 years. What was Jesus doing in that length of time? What really was his mission? Now, of course, you could answer and say, well, read the four Gospels and you'll know. And so I realize I'm boiling this down, very dramatically. But there are, in relation to marriage and divorce, I think, at least one theme we're going to discover that is highly enlightening when it comes to the two most controversial passages, which I believe are Matthew 5 and Matthew 19, particularly Matthew 19. Well, let's get this overview of Jesus' life again and try to keep it in our minds, because context matters. Now, I believe my great failure in years gone by was not being able to really see the context. I wasn't holding enough scriptural data in my head while I was so confidently answering questions that potentially could destroy people's marriages and families. And so I think a bit, lacking in evidence, I was very firm convicted, but I kept forgetting the context. So first, let's never forget that Galatians chapter 4, verses 4 and 5, we are told that God sent forth his Son, born of a woman, born under the law. Jesus was born under the law. And under that law he was born, so that he might redeem those who were under the law. That law is Moses' law, certainly Moses' law. It's the point of Galatians 4 and the argumentation Paul sets forth there. It'll be his point in many other places. The law that is twice mentioned in Galatians 4 that Jesus was born under, Jesus lived that perfect life so that he might redeem the people that were under the law. So it shouldn't surprise us that in Matthew 15 and 24, he declared, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." Jesus was not sent to the Gentiles. He interacted with a few Gentiles, but his mission was not to the Gentiles. He came to the house of Israel to redeem them from that law. Now, in Matthew 5:17, we've touched on this several times. We're going to be coming extensively to Matthew 5, verses 31 and 32 a little later in the class today. But in 5:17, he said, "Do not think I came to abolish the law or the prophets. I did not come to abolish, but to fulfill." Jesus' mission was to be the perfect living proof that Moses' law could be kept in absolutely every particular. This is what he did. He was born under that law. He obeyed that law. He never sinned once by that law. And furthermore, he added in 5:19 of Matthew, "Whoever annuls one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven, but whoever keeps and teaches them what? The commandments. What commandments? The law and the prophets, the 39 books of the Old Testament. Whoever annuls one of the least of those would not only be least in the kingdom, but please note in 20 he adds, unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you'll not enter the kingdom. You can't even get in, let alone, you know, have a ranking. You can't even get in the kingdom. He tells all those Jews to whom alone he was sent, very early in his ministry, Matthew 5, there on the shores of the Sea of Galilee, in the Sermon on the Mount. Unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you'll not enter the kingdom of heaven. This theme about the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees and how these people have to do better than that in order to get in the kingdom is a theme that is really a very prodigiously prominent theme in the book of Matthew, which particularly we're concerned about here. It has one of these four passages in the Gospels that deals with marriage, divorce, and remarriage. So let's think about this for a little while. Brethren, annulling the commandments, teaching others to annul the commandments, and disobeying the commandments of Moses' law was the Pharisees' stock in trade. Their whole position seemed to be built on that. Their power, their money is built on this. This is what they did. They thought of themselves as building a fence around the law by creating their own laws, which are called the traditions of the elders. And the traditions of the elders is what they taught instead of Moses' law. They annulled Moses' law in order to teach their traditions. They disobeyed Moses' law in order to teach their traditions. From the time that Jesus began his ministry by overturning the money changers' tables in the temple, what was Jesus doing then? What was he doing in the Sermon on the Mount? What was he doing throughout his entire life of 3.5 years of mission work? He was correcting those guys. He was not annulling the law. He was fulfilling it. He was not teaching people to annul the law. He was teaching it. And every time he goes to correcting anything that's related to the law, he is not correcting Moses. He's not setting Moses aside. He's not improving Moses. He's not going back to something that's better than Moses and was before Moses. What he's doing is correcting the misinterpretations, the annulments, and the disobedience of those Pharisees. Now, for instance, in Matthew 9, 11 through 13, and in all those passages, too, in Matthew. And in four more that I couldn't fit on the slide in Matthew. And in others not in Matthew, brethren. He addresses these guys. And I lost the context. I didn't quite grasp what Jesus was doing in Matthew's gospel. I took him most often to be correcting Moses, that he was going to elevate and bring into existence a law that was better than Moses, higher than Moses, that had preceded Moses, and Moses had reduced, but now was going to have to return. Now, I put these up on the screen for the sake of those who are watching on the video. I'm just going to say the numbers for those that are only listening to the audio, not looking at the video. And for all of you, you can jot these down if you like. But that what I'm talking about is Matthew 9, 11 through 13. They're all in Matthew. So, chapter 12, verses 2 through 8, chapter 12, verses 28 through 42, chapter 15, verses 1 through 9, chapter 15, verses 12 through 24, chapter 16, verses 6 through 12, 21, 15 and 16, 21, 23 through 27, 21, 43 through 45, 22, 15 through 22, 22, 23 through 32, 22, 34 through 40, chapter 23 now, 1 through 4, verse 6, verses 14 and 15, verses 16 through 22, verses 23 through 26, verses 27 and 28, and like I said, and four more. Brother, it took me quite a while to dig them all out, but it was worth the effort to see the context, to understand Jesus' mission, to see that he never sets Moses aside. He never corrects Moses. He never sets Moses down and elevates something else above him. He was only sent to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Do not think that he came to annul the law. And anybody that would teach that can't even get in the kingdom. He was born under it. So he taught it and he lived it. Now then, I do want to do just a very few of these. And again, I was missing a context. It's come much more clearly to me, even in these most recent studies. So I was seeing it, you know, I think fairly clearly for the last, you know, couple of decades now. But brethren, look at patterns that exist, and then ask yourself, when you see the elements of a pattern that, you know, has developed, and then you find it in another passage, well, maybe that pattern should be applied, you know, consistently in every place. So here's Matthew 12, 2 through 8. And I'm condensing now again. His disciples picked grain and ate. When the Pharisees saw it, they said, "Your disciples do what is not lawful." What law? The law before Moses? Christian law? Or Moses' law? Well, the Pharisees said, "What is not lawful on a Sabbath?" Moses' law is what interests them. And Jesus' response is, "Have you not read David and his, well, what David and his companions did? He entered the house of God. They ate consecrated bread, which was not lawful for him to eat, only the priests. Or have you not read in the law that on the Sabbath the priests in the temple break the Sabbath and are innocent? But I say to you, something greater than the temple is here. If you'd known what this means, 'I desire compassion and not sacrifice,'" a direct quote from Hosea 6:6, "you would not have condemned the innocent by your false application of what you act like you've never read in the law. You don't get Moses' law. So let me quote it for you and tell you, if you knew what Moses taught," and brethren, Moses taught compassion. Though for a lot of years I thought you couldn't find that in the Old Testament. That was only new in the mouth of Jesus. "No, if you understood what Hosea said, you would not have condemned the innocent. Condemn them under Moses' law, which you don't teach, which you annul, which you disobey, which you misrepresent. Have you not read? Have you not read in the law? Here's Hosea. Let me tell you what that law actually says." Look again here in Matthew 15, the first six verses, and we'll spill over into 7 through 9 on the next slide. 15, 1 through 6. "Pharisees came to Jesus. They said, 'Why do your disciples break the tradition of the elders?'" What are they defending? What are they preaching? The tradition of the elders. "They don't wash their hands when they eat. You cannot find that in Moses' law." So he said, "Why do you transgress God's commandment," which is Moses' law, "for the sake of your tradition? God said," then he quotes Exodus 20 and verse 12. "And God said," he quotes Exodus 20 verse 17. Is he setting the law aside? Is he saying it's inadequate now that he's here? Is he replacing it with something higher? No. He says, "You say, whoever says to his father or mother, 'Whatever I have that would help you has been given to God,' he's not to honor his father and mother. You, who? You Pharisees with your traditions, you Pharisees, you have invalidated the word of God for the sake of your tradition." Jesus one of his absolutely highest priority purposes for living on the earth is to demonstrate that these men, and no other Jew included, you cannot invalidate the Word of God. Moses' law cannot be invalidated while we're living under it. We're living under it. You're invalidating it with your tradition. Jesus was here to cite the Old Testament law so as to correct the misinterpretation thereof. He lived that law, he taught that law, and he corrected those who wouldn't. Here we go to 7 through 9, though. Look what happens, and think carefully about how you understand this passage. In Matthew 15, 7 through 9, the next sentence says, "You hypocrites, rightly did Isaiah prophesy of the denominational churches that'll spring up in the next few hundred years." That's how we apply the passage. That was the last thing on Jesus' mind, and an impossible thing for these Jews to consider. "You hypocrites, rightly did Isaiah prophesy of you. This people, the Jews, honors me with their lips, but their heart is far away from me. In vain do they worship me, here now in the temple and in Israel. In vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines the precepts of men, the traditions of the elders." Twice in the six verses that preceded this. Jesus is not establishing a new law. Jesus is not showing a superior way that Moses never rose to. He's citing the law, teaching it, practicing it, applying it to these men who are not obeying the law, not teaching the law. This is Jesus' mission. Matthew 21, 33 through 45, which I've greatly condensed, as you can tell. "Landowner planted a vineyard, put a wall around it, dug a wine press, built a tower, rented it to vine growers, and went on a journey. When the harvest time approached," remember this from our studies last week in Matthew 13. Those of you who are here for that, this will really ring some bells for you. I didn't do this last week in that sermon, but this would apply directly to that sermon. "When the harvest time approached," what harvest did we see in Matthew 13? Well, we'll review it when we get to the sermon that follows this class. "But when the harvest time approached, he sent slaves to receive his produce. Vine growers beat one, killed another, stoned a third. He sent more slaves. They did the same to them. Afterward, he sent his son, saying, 'They'll respect my son.' But they said, 'This is the heir. Come, let's kill him and seize his inheritance.' And so they did. They killed him. When the owner of the vineyard comes," I'm hoping a lot of bells are ringing. Jesus and a harvest and the son and being killed and then, you know, judgment. "When the owner of the vineyard comes, what will he do to those vine growers?" They said, "He'll bring them to a wretched end and rent out the vineyard to others who will pay him at the proper seasons." In other words, these vineyard renters, they're going to have a bad end. That's not the end of the planet, because he's going to rent the field out to other guys. So we're looking for a judgment. It's going to take place on the people who didn't do right, so that others can do right after them. So then he says, "Did you never read in the scriptures?" This is becoming a theme. It's becoming a chorus. It's becoming a refrain when Jesus is dealing with these men. So he says, "The stone which the builders rejected became the chief corner. This came about from the Lord. It's marvelous in our eyes." That's Psalm 118, 22 and following, which Jesus is not annulling. He's not setting aside. He's not improving on it. He's just saying, "I say to you, the kingdom of God will be taken away from you." Now, this has been big in our Sunday morning sermons and a number of other studies we've done through the years. I used to teach there was no kingdom in the Old Testament. Didn't exist. First time it came on scene is in Jesus. Brethren, how can you take a thing away from somebody that they don't have? Okay, right now. Every one of you, come up here, come get in, you know, the pocket of this jacket. And you can take $1 million out of there. If you find $1 million in there, But if it's not there, you can't take it away. Now can you? So, God, the kingdom of God, will be taken away from you and given to a people producing the fruit of it. When the chief priests, the Pharisees, heard his parables, they understood he was speaking about them. So what does Jesus do? It's now third time. We've seen just this morning. He cites the scriptures, accuses them of never reading them because of their false applications and understandings, so he corrects them. Let's look at Matthew 23, 16 through 22. Woe to you blind guides who say, whoever swears by the temple, that's nothing, but whoever swears by the gold of the temple is obligated. You fools! Which is more important, the gold or the temple that sanctifies the gold? You also say, whoever swears by the altar, that is nothing, but whoever swears by the offering on it, he is obligated. You blind men! Which is more important, the offering or the altar that sanctifies the offering? Therefore, whoever swears by the altar and everything on it. Whoever swears by the temple and him who dwells in it. How many of you think that's Christian doctrine, new and improved, better than Moses? Well, brethren, what altar and temple is he talking about? Jews' altar and temple is all under the law to correct their abuse of that law. So here's the last one of these, Matthew 23:23. Woe to you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! You tithe mint, dill, and cumin while neglecting the weightier provisions of the law, of Moses' law. The reason they invalidate the law is because they teach their traditions instead of it, by ignoring and neglecting the weightier provisions, which provisions I used to think weren't in Moses' law at all. How can they be condemned then? Those have to be in Moses' law. This justice, this mercy, this faithfulness, or he can't be on their case about it. But these things you should have done without neglecting the others. So there's Christian doctrine. This morning we'll take up a collection. Everybody will bring their mint and dill and cumin, and we'll tithe. Right? Of course not. We don't live under the law that Jesus did. We're not among the people to whom Jesus was sent only. We aren't under that law. Brethren, they were. And it was Jesus' mission to fix the problem. They were invalidating Moses' law with their traditions. So what now is Jesus doing in the Sermon on the Mount? Last week, we spent most of our time on it, but I knew, of course, you know, I couldn't touch all of it. I am fully aware of the literature. I've got that many debates and books and whatnot on my bookshelves, you know. I've been to several states to record debates. I've spent a lot of time and money with this, so I know I can't cover all of it. But what was he doing in the Sermon on the Mount, and what was he doing in Matthew 19? So, we're going to now, for just a minute, think about Matthew 19, and then we'll have next week the whole class, maybe even another week, on Matthew 19. That's really the heart of the matter. But even before we get back to Matthew 5 this morning, think about 22 passages that we just briefly looked at, more in other Gospels, but just in Matthew. Now we come to Matthew 19:9. Pharisees came to testing Jesus and asking, Lord, when you set up the new kingdom here after you raised from the dead, will it be lawful to divorce a wife for any reason at all? Did they say that? Did they think that? Could they have imagined that? Did the apostles get that? That's not what they're asking. And if Jesus does not answer the question they asked, then that question is never answered by Jesus. Period. Did Jesus just ignore the question? Or did he answer it in the context of 22 other passages in Matthew where he's dealing with those same Pharisees? is it lawful to divorce a wife for any reason at all? And he answered, have you not read? What did he do every other time he told those guys, have you not read? And then he cites a passage. Genesis 1:27, Genesis 2:24. Every other time Jesus uses that refrain, he uses that form, he's established this pattern. Every other time he uses this expression, did he set Moses' law aside? Did he annul it? Did he improve on it? Did he say, this is Christian law, but not Moses' law? Did he give them something they'd never heard before? Or did he do what we've been watching all morning? He said, you've invalidated the word of God because of your tradition. Now let me cite the passages and tell you what the truth of the matter is. Now we'll deal with Matthew 19 because their response is to cite Deuteronomy 24. And it was at that point Jesus for the first time ever says, okay, well, with regard to marriage law, but nothing else, I'm going to improve it. So here, for this one time, I'm going to set it aside, tell you what you ought to be doing. I'm going to annul Moses. Of course not. But I thought so for years. For years I thought that. No. When he says, have you not read, and he cites passages, or when they introduce Moses' law, he deals with Moses' law. And if he doesn't, then he's not a part of the kingdom. He's not even in the kingdom. Because he doesn't teach it, and he doesn't practice it, and most importantly, he's teaching that part of it can be annulled for these people who are still living under it. You cannot annul Moses' law while people are still living under it. Until Jesus dies to do away with Moses' law, he cannot teach anyone to set aside Moses' law. If he does, he disqualifies himself as our sacrifice for sin. He just became a sinner because he has broken the law. He's annulled it. He's taught others to annul it. If Jesus does that while these people are still under it, then he's no longer our sacrifice for sin. The consequences of studying Jesus in context eluded me for a very long time. So let's see. I don't want you to think I came to abolish the law of the prophets. I came to fulfill it. You know one of the least of these commandments. You teach others to do that, you'll be least in the kingdom and you can't even get in it. You people on the shores of the Sea of Galilee, all you Jews, the only people I'm sent to at the beginning of my ministry, I'm going to tell you about those scribes and Pharisees, and you got to do better than they did. In other words, you can't invalidate the law. You got to keep it. You have to obey it. You have to live it. You have to teach it. And that's what Jesus is doing in Matthew 5. And I gave very short shrift, you know, just time constraints last week. So grab your pencils and pens. This morning now, I'm going to go through all six of the contrasts. Open to Matthew chapter 5. Here's where I thought for so long the contrast was between Jesus and Moses. The contrast was between Christianity and the old law. Here's where I thought for years, Jesus said, well, Moses taught that, but we're not going to do that anymore. This is the beginning of his ministry. I didn't come to annul it. I didn't come to abolish it. He just told them that. And then he says in Matthew 5, 21 through 26. Now you see, this is number one of the six contrasts. I've given you the exact same reference on both sides of the screen here. Now what we're going to do is we're going to look at the "but I say unto you" information, which I used to think was brand new. No Jew could find it in the Old Testament. It's something, you know, unknown to Moses' law. This is Jesus teaching, "but I say unto you." And then over here, what we're going to look at is what the law said. Now, six times I thought you couldn't find any of this in the old law until I found out that repeatedly you find it everywhere in the old law. And it was paradigm changing. Well, now, wait a minute. Is Jesus correcting Moses or maybe somebody else? Is Jesus maybe he's showing how your righteousness, you Jews, to whom only he was sent, could exceed that of the scribes and Pharisees. Now, they were invalidating the law because they wouldn't keep it, and they taught others not to. maybe the contrast is not between Jesus and Moses. Maybe it's between Jesus and the Pharisees. So here in the first one, everyone who's angry with his brother shall be guilty according to the three levels of courts that are stipulated there. And then he says, name calling is forbidden too. Can't say Reka, can't say you fool to your brother. But now look, here's Deuteronomy 19, 11 through 13, and Proverbs 29, 11. There's more. This is all a fit. You shall not hate your countrymen in your heart. Now, I used to think there isn't any heart stuff in the Old Testament. It's all just physical. It's all just, you know, salvation by perfect law keeping, but the heart's not involved. Well, that's Deuteronomy 19 says you can't hate your brother in your heart. You shall not bear any grudge. And that's about 99.86% of every anger you've ever had with anybody. And against the sons of your people, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Well, it's not new. That's Deuteronomy and Leviticus 19 both. A fool utters all his anger, but a wise man keeps it back, says Proverbs 29:11. Well, that kind of puts an end to name-calling, doesn't it? When you're angry with your brother, shut your mouth. So all this stuff I thought was new, I began to find one after the other and repeated and repeated and repeated, and the law was there all along. I just didn't know it. In 5:27 through 30, we have the second of the six contrasts. Everyone who looks on a woman who lusts for her has committed adultery already, you know, with her in your heart. Now remember, in the old law, there is no heart stuff, and it never teaches that lust is wrong. That's what I used to believe on both counts. What's the problem here? Well, Exodus 20 says you shall not covet your neighbor's wife. That's verse 17. Job 31, Job said, I made a covenant with my eyes. How then could I gaze at a virgin? Job was practicing this, don't you be looking at a woman to lust after her. And then you've got Proverbs 6:25, do not desire her beauty in your heart. Now, y'all remember, these passages do not exist in the old law. Have you not read? And that was my problem. I just hadn't. So I was making grand declarations, counseling people to destroy their marriages based on the idea that I could not find this in the old law. But I did. And it's exactly what Jesus said. Nothing new, nothing better, nothing improved, nothing different than what Moses said. Now, please note with this one that I'm skipping to number 4. You know, that's what the square's about. 3 is the one in contention here, so we'll come back to 3 at the end. See what he did before in these contrasts. See what he did after these contrasts. And then ask yourself if he did something totally different when it came to marriage and divorce. So in number 4, Matthew 5, 33 through 37, make no oath at all, not by heaven, earth, Jerusalem, or your own head. Just say yes or no. Well, of course, we all know that can't be found in Ecclesiastes 5, 5, now can it? Where it says it's better you should not vow than that you vow and not pay. Now, brethren, it's exactly the same thing. You know, so my problem, I guess, was, you know, I went in my concordance looking for oath by heaven or oath by Jerusalem and didn't realize that the council, just don't take oaths, was there all along. It's exactly the same thing. That's a mistake I just noticed. That should be number 5 as well. The fifth of the six contrasts is Matthew 5, 38 through 42. Do not resist him who is evil. Now, you can if you're under Moses' law, of course. But now, I'm telling you, you can't. Used to be you Jews did not have this law. You could resist whom, you know, the evil person. But now, I, Jesus, I'm going to fix that. Turn your cheek. Give your coat. Go the extra mile. Loan money if they ask you for it. Now, you can't find any of that in the old law, can you? Well, there's Exodus 23. You shall not follow the masses in doing evil, nor testify in a dispute so as to pervert justice. If you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey wandering away, you shall surely return it to him. If see the donkey of one who hates you lying helpless under its load, you shall refrain from leaving it to him. You shall surely release it. You shall not pervert the justice due your needy brother in his dispute. Now, if there's anything that the Pharisees were renowned for, it was their lawsuits and pillaging the orphan and the widow. Jesus got on their case about that, didn't he? And I didn't even show it to you today. Brethren, you got a dispute mentioned twice. You got an evil guy. He's your enemy. You know, what are you supposed to do? Jesus phrased it as explaining the law, inspired interpretation. Turn the other cheek, give your coat, go the extra mile, loan them money. The Old Testament's full of that loaning money one. I'm not putting them all up, but you know that. We've been studying the old law, Leviticus and Numbers. You have to give your brother money. Well, it doesn't matter if he's your enemy or not. Six, last one. Matthew 5:43-48. But I say unto you, love your enemies. Now, you didn't have to do that under the old law. Pray for them, be perfect, as your heavenly Father is perfect. Now, we all understand nobody had to be like the Father under the old law. Did they? Yes, of course they did. It's just that I didn't know it. If your enemy is hungry or thirsty, give him food and drink, is found in Leviticus 19. Proverbs 25 says, you shall not take vengeance, bear any grudge against the sons of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Doesn't matter if he's your enemy and you're in a court of law and there's a dispute. And then you got, you shall be holy, for I, Yahweh, am holy, in Leviticus 19. And as a matter of fact, I'm begging you all, go back to Leviticus 19, because you'll realize that that whole chapter bears on this. I've cited verse 17 before. I've cited verse 18 here. And now we're looking at 19:2. That 19th chapter of Leviticus is pretty important to us. It's the one right after all the nakedness, where all the sexual sins are listed, where porneia is defined, fornication. Then he says, you shall be holy, for I am holy, in the next chapter, second verse. Brother, they're identical teachings. They're different words. I use different words all the time. Every time I use a different phrase, does that mean I've broken Jesus' teaching? When you're explaining a thing, you use different words so that people can understand what the words that you're talking about mean. Now look at this number three. Here's Matthew 5:31-32. What is Jesus doing? Is he now, one time out of six, not going to correct the Pharisees? Not going to show them what the law teaches? Will he finally annul that Deuteronomy 24? He's going to get rid of that for sure. First thing off when he goes teaching the Jews, everyone who divorces his wife except for fornication makes her commit adultery. And if you marry a divorced woman except for fornication, because the exception applies to both clauses, always does, that's just the laws of grammar. Whoever marries a divorced woman, except in the case of fornication, commits adultery. Okay, that's Jesus' brand new teaching. Never could find that in the old law, except in Deuteronomy 24, which he's quoting. So, we study Deuteronomy 24. Man marries a wife. She finds no favor in his eyes because he found the nakedness in her that's defined at such enormous length in Leviticus 18, their law for the last 39 years. So we get to Deuteronomy 24. Nakedness is porneia. It's fornication and sexual sin. He finds that in her. What does he do? He writes her a certificate of divorce. He sends her out of his house, and they both can marry again. That's the law. And that's exactly what Jesus taught. Identically. And if not, then his death on that cross is meaningless to everybody in this room. If he annuls Deuteronomy 24 at the start of his ministry, or teaches anybody else to do it, they decide to do that in the next 3.5 years because he taught it on the shore of the Sea of Galilee, then Jesus can't be in the kingdom, can't be sin-free by the law, and therefore cannot be our Paschal Lamb. The consequences of my failing to understand the context, not just surrounding verses, but the whole book and then the whole mission, were profound. Well, guess I got that now. Okay. So my point is here, brethren, there are no easy divorces in the old law. There's no divorce for anything other than fornication. The only divorce that's supposed to take place, that's stipulated in Moses' law, the only place you're going to read about the certificate of divorce in the law, is because of a matter of nakedness. It's because of fornication. Jesus taught exactly the same thing that the law taught. Now, let's just think this quickly through in the last 5 minutes. In all six of these contrasts, Jesus cites the law. Every one of them. You can see all capital letters. Jesus cites Moses' law every time in those six contrasts. Is that so he could contradict it, set it aside, improve on it, bring you a better one? No. He then all six times demonstrates how the Pharisees were invalidating it. And he'll spend his whole ministry doing that. 22 times just in Matthew where they're named and more. Brethren, he does that by citing more of the law every time. So I just did six of them. I put them up for you. I showed you the Old Testament passages that teach the same thing that follows the "but I say unto yous." All six times. All Jesus did was cite other places in the law. Use different expressions to prove that he was born under the law, that he was keeping the law, that he was teaching the law, and that in verse 21, after he just had said, "I'm not annulling it, and don't think that," he then gives six contrasts to prove that he is not annulling the law. He's annulling the Pharisees' false teaching. The contrast is not between Jesus and Moses. It's between Moses, as properly interpreted by Jesus, and the Pharisees. "Unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you'll not enter the kingdom of heaven." Then he shows them six times where the Pharisees fail to enter the kingdom, where they fail to obey the law, where they're annulling it. So he says, you got to do better than they're doing, and here are six different ways they're messing it up right now. And then the rest of his ministry. Now, I've got 2 minutes, so I just want to close with one more thing. Please, everybody, look in your Bibles actually at 5:31 and 32. Have a close look at this now. 5:31 is the third of the six contrasts. "It was said, whoever sends his wife away, let him give her a certificate of divorce. That is not what the law says. The law says, whoever finds a matter of nakedness in his wife, and therefore his heart is hardened toward her, can give her a certificate of divorce." These Pharisees cite part of the law so they can abuse the law and divorce their wives for any reason they want. Jesus cites all of the law and says, no, you can't, because I'm born under it, I'm the Son of the living God, I'm keeping it, and I'm teaching it, and you Pharisees are wrong. So I thought, and I had it on good authority because everybody who'd ever taught me said so, that makes her commit adultery proves that Jesus is bringing something new and more difficult, you know, a higher law and all the rest of that. Because under Moses' law, in the culture of the Jews, women had a secondary kind of a status, no rights, I was taught. And therefore, if a husband divorces her, she can either starve to death, get married, or become a prostitute. How many of you heard their culture was such that they just, most of them, be driven to prostitution? It's all over the books and the teaching, you know, that's just what it is. Makes her commit adultery means you force her either to become a prostitute or marry a guy she shouldn't. Now, of course, that puts Jesus against Moses and against Deuteronomy 24, which he just said he wasn't going to do. But how then can he make a woman commit adultery? How do you make any woman commit adultery? My wife wouldn't do that. Nor would anybody else's in this room. Not a single woman in this room is going to be driven to prostitution. That's not what he's talking about. 1 John 1:10 says that anybody who says they have no sin makes God a liar. So clearly, we've made her indulge in an illicit sexual act, the same way we have the power to make God tell lies. When was the last time you ordered God to tell a lie? When was the last time you put him in a position where he had no other choice? When was the last time when you made God a liar by making him tell a lie? Well, you never have. Knows it, never anybody else. Context of my Bible. Patterns and expressions that I wasn't seeing before. Brethren, you divorce a woman who is not guilty of fornication under Moses' law, and you've written her a certificate of divorce that says, since this certificate can only exist for women who have committed adultery, and I'm giving it to you, then I am making you an adulteress. I am making you commit adultery the same way you can make God a liar. By making him out to be a liar. By making him look like a liar. By representing him as a liar. I don't believe or practice what he says, so he has to be wrong. He's the liar. Here, pure, perfectly covenant-keeping, faithful wife is your certificate of divorce, which Moses taught was only for one reason. Fornication. You're an adulteress, and you need this ticket so that you can marry another guy. So that every guy will know that you're an adulteress. But she isn't. She'd done nothing wrong. And there's no easy divorce in the old law. I gave her a certificate of divorce. I've made her an adultery just as sure as you can make God a liar. You've represented her as a thing she is not. Except for fornication, there should never be a certificate of divorce. Thank you very much.